thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
Well, you heard one.
Here's John Williams.
That qualifies as a big thought, doesn't it? Hi, it's John. It's 108. We're downtown Chicago overlooking, well,
Lord have mercy.
Let me look over my shoulder here. Gray skies, wet streets. It's not snowing or raining here now, but it's a common. Rained hard last night, huh? And so because of that weather, the question is, should you just move Halloween from October 31, when the sun goes to rest, to a more hospitable day? Remember now, in the 2 o'clock hour, some Chicago public school teachers will be in our studio, not to do the he said, she said about the contract negotiations, although I'll ask them a little bit about that. But, you know, it seems to me like one thing that's been absent from this conversation is a discussion about what's it like in the classroom. Class size, the needs of the students, are the children coming with special issues because they're living in the city of Chicago, and that can be hard on kids. I mean, tell me what it's like, teachers. So they will. Thank you. Those of you that responded to my Facebook petition for you to participate, we heard from some of you, and we've rounded some of you up. One other quick note about my Facebook page, and then we'll go on to this trick-or-treating thing here. But after yesterday's show, and in fact during yesterday's show, some of you asked for the statistics I was spouting off about crime in Chicago and Illinois. The president came to town and reminded everybody that this is a violent city, and I understand that, and I think we need to fix that, but I always get very defensive when people come into town and start to kick around my Chicago, your Chicago. We know it's violent, but at least let's be clear about it. Is it more violent than St. Louis? St. Louis has a murder rate 3 times higher than Chicago. Think about that. And on the list goes, not just murder, but then violent crimes. And some of the things that you hear about Chicago, like it's more dangerous than Afghanistan, but is it really? So anyway, we put all of that in a post. And it's been shared more times than just about anything I've ever put on Facebook. You can see it on my Facebook page. I'm WGN King John. This is on NBC News, and it's about little old Vernon Hills. Hey, Vernon Hills, you're on the TV. Vernon Hills is going to reschedule trick-or-treating from Thursday. They're going to do it on Saturday from 2 to 5. They're going to have Halloween on, I don't even know what day that is. I'm sure that information's available. Due to the forecast of inclement weather, I'm reading now from NBCChicago.com. Due to the forecast of inclement weather and anticipated accumulations, Jen just told you, of up to 3 inches of snow, the village is concerned for the safety of the children crossing the streets when traffic conditions will be at their worst. Therefore, they say, authorized hours for trick-or-treating will be moved from the traditional day of Halloween. There's no outrage here. There's no, because at the end of the day, all we're saying is that kids are going to walk around the neighborhood and get candy on the 2nd instead of on the 31st. That's all we're saying. But the subtext to that is, right, that we do pave the way for everything for our kids, don't we? And I don't know if this is about the kids or about the parents who are always trying to make things right for their children. So what if they remembered that in 2019 when they went trick-or-treating, they did it in the snow and their costume got wet and their feet were cold?
Yeah, I have memories of a lot of really bad Halloweens.
And that's part of your treasure trove of recollections about the holiday.
Yeah.
Now,
part of the experience.
If they do it on the 31st, right, and then a car slides into some kids and people question the judgment of the city fathers, that would be tragic. So I see what they're trying to do here, but I also see what we are all doing here, and that is we are ensuring that our children do not undergo any hardship that we can prevent. That's what we're doing.
So you're seeing this more as a everyone gets a trophy kind of thing. Why are we babying them?
Yeah.
Okay. This is a country of drill sergeants. I read the comments in response to your news click, and obviously the news click answer prevailing vote was that we are babying and what is it? It's a trick. Bad idea. We're getting soft. Come on. Or in your voice. Come on.
Are you impersonating me now, Elif?
Yeah. Well, I impersonate everybody.
Vernon
but
Hills.
That's not the point. I think this is a country of drill sergeants who we already are so diligent in every other area of our lives. We go to work 9 to 5 or more. Sometimes people are crazy overworked, and apparently CTU is. That's their position. Just as an example, when we're sick, we go to work. Can't we just have an enjoyable Halloween that's not snowy? I hate snow.
So move it to the second.
Yeah.
And not overthink it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, not overthink it. Exactly. Oh my God, they have to wait 3 more days for candy.
Everyone seems to want to give a reason for things, and a lot of them are negative, like you're saying, Elif. And I don't know why we do that.
Yeah. Like, okay, well, I'll put my feet up one more day and enjoy the evening with my kids watching Halloween movies instead. I'm not a mother, but...
Here's the news click. Vernon Hills and towns across the country. They're doing this in New Jersey, Philadelphia, places like that. I mean, other towns where this bad storm is coming or is gone. I don't know what they did in Denver. Maybe it'll be melted by then. But Vernon Hills, no, it's not going to be. In fact, Denver, it's like below zero, for crying out loud. Anyway, Vernon Hills and towns across the country are rescheduling Halloween due to the weather. You had two options, treat or trick. A, treat, good idea. Schlepping around in the snow, no thanks, 30%. Trick, bad idea. Drill sergeant, we're getting soft, come on, 70%. So where are you? My number's 312-981-7200.
Can we have a who cares option?
No, because that would have won. That would have won, and I'm not looking for that. I'm looking for opinions. Also, we don't do any holiday. Maybe this is kind of to the point, Lauren, you were making an Elif, and that is we don't do anything anymore that we don't invent a controversy around it. You can't have Christmas that you don't have controversy around. All kinds of things about Christmas these days, including
Happy holidays, John.
No. Right.
And by the way, somewhere in between is Thanksgiving, and I'm sure we'll be outraged about that. It just seems like we don't do anything anymore that we don't just find reason to argue. And here's another traditional Halloween argument. Kmart has pulled a Halloween costume from their shelves in Australia. I suspect you'd find this in the USA, too. After a woman created a petition accusing the company of at least bad judgment, there's a change.org petition with thousands of signatures after the woman discovered the children's costume in a Kmart store called Bride Costume, and it shows a little girl wearing a white dress with a headband veil. So your daughter, and this says it's appropriate for girls between 4 and 6, goes out as a bride for Halloween. Years ago, you would not have thought anything about that, and maybe even up to today. But by today, some of you go, wow, is that inappropriate? We have a problem with trafficking of little girls in this world. Dressing them up as brides is really a bad idea. And thousands of people have signed on, and Kmart pulled the costume. Another holiday controversy. Hey, Karen, you're on WGN. What did you want to say? You're on the air.
How you doing?
Good. What's up?
Okay, hey, listen, my community had their trick-or-treating this past Sunday. Nobody thinks twice about it, and lo and behold, it was an absolutely gorgeous Sunday. It is always the Sunday before Halloween. Now, it is awkward that it's going to be delayed now into November, but it is what it is. I had 335 kids.
On the 27th of October.
I was going to say, God bless you.
October.
Yeah. And you look great, by the way.
Yeah. Amazing. Amazing. My husband had to dig out his 50 quarters.
What town was that? What town?
Well, anyway.
What town, Karen?
I'm Northern Lake County, Round Lake.
Okay. Thank you for the phone call. So Halloween was on the 27th of October there. Nobody raised a fuss. Paul, you're on WGN. What'd you want to say, Paul? You're on the air.
Hey, John, I am not a fan of It Is What It Is. I'm sorry. I grew up on the northwest side of Chicago near Mayfair Park. I live up in McHenry now. I'm 43 years old. And I think, you know, back in the day when I was doing Halloween, it was raining. It was cold. Sometimes it was nice. You know what? I'm talking about it now because I remember those days. It wasn't always sunshine and rainbows.
Yeah.
It is what it is. I'm sick and tired. old man Paul here. I'm sick and tired of just let's change Christmas. Let's change Valentine's Day. My brother, God bless him, he works. You know, we there's some things you accommodate for, but Christmas is Christmas, birthdays are birthdays, Halloween's Halloween. Let it be.
Do you have kids?
Leave it be.
Do you have kids, Paul?
I don't.
No, I don't think that.
But I like.
That's okay. That doesn't change your argument, I don't think. I just wondered.
No, I don't. I like kids. I love kids.
Here's my point. If you did have to schlep them out in this weather, I wonder if that wouldn't change your enthusiasm for the way things used to be.
No. No, I would. I mean, it's either you go out or you don't. It either it sucks out. We didn't get much candy or whatever. I mean, listen, if places want to bend over backwards and make Halloween happen, fine. But I'm just tired of. I want to see a stronger future. I want to see kids get cold, get wet, get snowy, get sick, get stronger. Stop throwing trophies at them and giving them prizes for just for participating. Like it is what it is. I'm not a fan of it, but. If I had to go out, John, I would. I'd have fun with it. I'd have some hot chocolate, some apple cider, whatever it is, and we'd call it a day. Maybe even make a snowman in the process. Who knows?
I'm glad you're listening. Thanks for the call.
Yep. Love you.
Have a good day. Maybe a little schnapps en route with the hot cocoa going on. I don't know if parents do that anymore. But
oh, for sure.
It's been known to happen in some neighborhoods. Okay, there's another view, 312-981-7200. You can call or text. I'm kind of with him, to be honest with you.
Well, I get that. Changing anything just because it's cold, that's one thing. I do believe in the argument that, okay, it's going to be slick on the roads. Already, there are a lot of accidents involving pedestrians on Halloween because they're wearing dark clothing. It's dark outside. And then you add slippery roads, especially when people might be out drinking, adults.
Yep.
So, you know.
Well, those are the pros and cons of it, all right? And then at some point you have to make a decision. And I don't think the danger is so imminent and so grave that we have to pull the kids off the street. You might even argue that on a really nice night, if it was 60 degrees and pleasant outside, there'd be more kids and more traffic. I'll bet you aren't going to see much of anything in this weather.
From what I know of Vernon Hills, there aren't a lot of sidewalks anyway. I mean, I think it's a lot of street road walking.
Along on the roads there, huh? Let's talk to Derek. Hey, Derek, you're on WGN. What did you want to say?
I agree kind of with that other caller about either you go out in the weather as it is, or you just don't go. Yeah. Maybe have a different. When I was trick or treating, I dressed as a pumpkin when it rained, and it was one of those plastic leaf bags, and you stay dry.
Yeah, I'm feeling you, man. That's kind of the way we did it at my house, too.
Right. I've got two kids that are going to go trick-or-treating tomorrow, no matter what.
What neighborhood, Derek?
Way out in the country.
No, really, tell me, do you mind? What town?
Sheridan.
Sheridan. Oh, hey, you're in my old neck of the woods.
Yes, kind of, yeah.
I mean, if we're talking Plano, Yorkville, Sandwich, Sominock, Pawpaw, out that way?
You got it. You got it.
Yeah, I used to work at WSPY, Plano, Illinois. I lived in Sandwich. It was a suburb of Pawpaw. Thanks for the call, Derek.
Thank you.
Yeah, have a great day. Hey, Colleen, you got, what is it, four kids, it says here? Hi, Colleen.
Hi, John. Yes, I do have four kids, and my youngest is 22 years old. And I think I remember one good Halloween.
And the rest were pretty lousy, and you made it. Is that what you're telling me?
They were very lousy, and all four of my children are still living. And I also have a 12-year-old granddaughter whose mother has decided if it's bad tomorrow, she's not going out. You know, and Vernon Hills has plenty of subdivisions where these kids can go trick-or-treating. I don't have a problem with them, holding it off till the weekend, that's fine. But, we are coddling these kids these days. If it's nice, you want your kid to go out, then they go out. And that's it.
Colleen, thanks for the call. From you to Mark on line 3, you're on WGN. Hey, Mark, you're on the air. What do you know?
Hey, John, always love your show. You're always fun. My son, when he was about 5, it's about the 26 now, but it was the night they retired Dick Butkus' jersey. at a Monday night football game, and the rain was horizontal. I mean, it was just crazy, crazy rain. He wanted to go out trick-or-treating. There was nobody else out, and within about three or four houses, people felt so sorry for him. They literally dumped their entire bowls of candy into his bag.
I was thinking
that. So he was done in about 10 minutes, got home, was able to watch his retirement. It was awesome.
Thanks for the phone call. I was thinking about that. The kids who do make it out in this, I mean, you got a 7-year-old there with a Scooby-Doo costume or a dinosaur or a princess or whatever they are, and they got snow on them. Oh, my God, they're getting the big candy bars. Clarence, get a big candy bar. Run to Walgreens then. That's what happens. You just take all you want, honey. Hey, John 630 says, wind gusts 39 miles an hour. Come on now. But some of you are saying things like, oh, for Pete's sake. The usual rainy, snowy Halloween made us appreciate the occasional Halloween that we didn't get soaking wet. 847, oh, God, think of the children. Give me a break. We never did this, and we're better off for it. 630, Halloween is October 31st. Why move it? I recall, Steve, maybe you do too. Maybe I just made this up and you don't recall it. Anyway, didn't we discuss moving Christmas? Haven't we had that conversation to putting it closest to the weekend nearest?
Really?
Christmas?
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
You can't do Christmas. That.
No.
So we're not going to do that.
But they were going to move the 4th of July.
That's what it was.
I think you do that.
Right. Which, I'm sorry, when the... Think about that. When the name of the holiday has the date on it, we're still having that conversation. So the concept's in play, as they say. Elaine, you're on
the air. Yes.
Hi, you're on the air. What do you want to say, Elaine?
Okay, all I wanted to say is that years and years ago, someone had told me that Halloween is a day to worship the devil. And if you notice, they kind of nasty weather almost every Halloween.
Well, thank you for that warm, cheery thought.
Just saying.
Thank you.
Hey, I remember 7th grade for me, which was probably 2002. It was like 70 degrees. I was out in a tank top for Halloween trick-or-treating.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What was the last age at which you trick-or-treated?
Freshman in high school, 14.
Yeah, that's kind of where I wrote it off. I mean, I still wanted the candy. I wasn't too proud to go door-to-door, but you know, I was with a bunch of grade schoolers, so it just didn't feel right. It wasn't as much fun as it used to be. So then you have those awkward years where do you go? You can't really go to a party. You're not drinking yet. So that's kind of an odd place. And then you get to be old enough to misbehave, and there you go again. It's the arc of Halloween for American children.
There really aren't tricks anymore, are there?
No. In fact, you go to jail if you do tricks. Did you guys do that? Did anybody ever, play pranks on people besides TPing and eggs?
I used to soap people's windows, but now they'd shower gel them, and it wouldn't work.
Here we go. Trisha Vernon Hills, you're on WGN Radio. What do you want to say, Trisha? Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Hey, I was just thinking, I know a lot of people bus their kids to different places. Vernon Hills best be prepared because there might be a lot of extra people there trying to get their candy.
Oh, that's right. So now the word's out. That's the place to go, huh?
Yeah. Especially if tomorrow's bad weather, they might just be going out on All Souls Day to get their candy.
Thank you for the call. I'm out of time. 1:30, Phil Vitale comes in, restaurant critic of the Chicago Tribune. Among other things, I'm asking Phil about the review that is scandalous in the New York Times. Have you heard about this?
Last night, I didn't sleep. I was so stressed.
There's a lot of tossing and turning these days.
I had a dream that I was on a call to Ukraine.
All this political talk can make a person drowsy, irritable, and a little crazy.
When I woke up, I saw that I had called a crane company. I now own a $400,000 crane.
And that's a sign of politosis.
Politosis? Can you get me something for that? And do you have any big construction projects coming up?
The answer is no to big projects.
Darn.
But the answer is yes to politosis, and the cure is Eurelium Life 9000.
Was Eurylium, one of the Russians?
No, Eurylium Life 9000 is the all-new, all-natural wonder drug made by an ethnically blended group of scientists in New Jersey.
Will it help me sleep?
Duh. It tackles lack of sleep, sore throats, itchy eyes, runny nose, scurvy, whooping cough, Dutch elm disease, and a host of gastrointestinal disorders, including but not limited to ringworm, nausea, constipation, too much gas, not enough gas. Hey, have you seen the price of gas lately? And that thing where your intestines aren't lined up right?
Did you say Dutch elm disease?
Take Eurylium Life 9000 is a pill, liquid, chewable briquette, capsule, gel cap, eye drop, nasal mist, ear burst, time release arm patch, powder, ointment, cream, and now an exciting new home epidural kit that has had some success.
So when I get stressed out about all this political talk, I should just take Eurylium Life 9000, right?
Don't take Eurylium Life 9000 if you're pregnant, operating heavy machinery, or plan on getting pregnant while operating heavy machinery.
Well, I do have this crane.
Somebody came up to me at the station today and said, I like the chewable briquette, and I didn't know what they were talking about. And I said, oh, wait, that's how I like my Eurylium Life 9000. Phil Vitale's the restaurant critic at the Chicago Tribune. How will you take your Eurylium Life?
With a grain of salt, I think, after listening to all that.
Well put. Hi, Phil Vitale.
Good.
I want to talk to Joe Brand on sports for three minutes. How are you, by the way?
I'm fine, thank you.
Three-star and four-star review.
I know, I was just passing them out like Halloween candy today.
For two restaurants in Chicago, you got to hear about these places. And also, I want to know what you think about the review controversy in the New York Times today.
Mm-hmm.
It's about, was it Peter Luger's?
Peter Luger's Steakhouse.
That's a famous steak place?
It's an iconic New York steakhouse.
The review is being read for entertainment value. It mm-hmm. rips this place so. Where's the line? Have you ever written a review like that? What did you think of this review in a minute? Joe Brand does sports for us on Saturdays, and you hear him in a number of capacities around White Sox baseball for us. In fact, he's the play-by-play voice of the Kane County Cougars. Someday when, I don't know, the White Sox, Cubs, Red Sox, one of those announcers retires, you're going to hear Joe Brand in a booth somewhere up there. Hi, Joe Brand. How are you?
Hi, John. Very high words. Thank you very much.
Okay, two things to ask you about the World Series last night. First of all, in that game last night, the Nationals, Game 6 of the World Series, Trey Turner hits a slow roller to third. He runs to first base. He goes straight for the base. The pitcher, Brad Peacock, fields the ball, throws it to first. The runner doesn't do anything wrong in this play, but the throw was up the line. And so the first baseman reaches out to catch it. The runner, Turner, collides with the glove. The ball goes into right field. Turner goes on to second base. But the umpire says that the runner impeded the first baseman, even though he didn't veer out of the line. He did impede the first baseman through no fault of his own. After instant replay reviews that went like 5 minutes, Turner's eventually called out. The manager, by the way, Davey Martinez, almost had another coronary on the field. He touched the umpire, by the way, so in my book, he has to be tossed. Give me your thoughts about all of that.
Yeah, well, the call was that Turner interfered with the throw to first, and the interference starts at the 45-foot line of the first base line. So you've got your fair foul line down the first base line, and then there's a 45-foot line to the right of the foul line. That's 3 feet to the right of it in foul territory near the first base dugout. That's the base running lane for the base runner. From home to first base is 90 feet. So the first 45 feet, the runner is allowed to veer off the line. But once you get to the 45 line marker, you have to be in the line. So as soon as Turner is not inside that path, there is the possibility for him to be called for interference if he ends up interfering with the fielder at first base. And that's exactly what happened.
Right.
And I know a lot of people have backlash about it. I know a lot of people were against it. But when you really break it down, freeze frame what happened and look at the rule book, it is unfortunately pretty cut and dry that the umpires got this one right.
Okay,
but
America and Twitter, and I think Phil Vitale, restaurant critic at the Chicago Tribune, blew up last night when that happened. Am I right about that, Phil?
Well,
yes.
I did not have any skin in this particular game, so I did not blow up, but I thought, wow, what a bad call. I mean, if he's got 1 foot on the line, it's not his fault if the catcher flings the ball to the foul side of first base.
Yeah, and how many times have we seen runners really impede, like really go out of their way to get in the way? Mm-hmm. He was not doing that. He was straight as an arrow to first base.
So according to this rule, could the catcher just drill the runner in the back and make him be out every time? No, I'm asking.
Well, actually, that's been known to be, that's been a strategy. They said that.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. John Schmoltz said that on the air last night. But again, you got to remember it was the pitcher fielding the ball. But this rule is in place basically for those bunt, swinging bunt actions, because when the runner just runs down to first, if you maybe lean inside the line, then you cut off the throw from the catcher, and that's what it's there for. It's to protect the defense from making an accurate throw over to first. Really, the rule book benefits everybody but the runner.
Okay, so you're saying, Joe, that the call was right, but the rule is not great.
Correct, correct. I mean, really, the base runner is not given many options in this circumstance because he's a right-handed hitter. So the most direct path from the right-handed batter's box to the first base bag is on an angle where you run
on the line,
inside the base path, of where you need to go.
And you can't see. So even if you wanted to help out your cause by ducking or sliding into first base, you
waving
can't
your
see
arms
because but the ball's behind you. You have no way of even knowing if you're in the way of the ball.
And also, if the ball is bunted into fair territory and the guy is running on the line, if he's interfering with the angle of the throw, then the throw should have been to the outside.
That's
not
what
to
I'm
the
thinking.
Inside.
Then throw the ball closer to the infield instead of the foul ball line, Joe Brand.
I agree. I mean, it wasn't an accurate toss, but by the rule book, the umpires get it right because that 45-foot line, you'll see it. It's just a chalk line parallel with the foul line, and that's kind of the runner's indication, okay, when you get to this point, you need to be in this base path.
I understand.
I don't really like how it's halfway. I feel like when a runner's going full speed, everything's on the line, set aside game six of the World Series, you're not thinking, all right, I need to get over here by the time I get to there.
Oh, I think the runner knew. I think Trey Turner knew darn good and well.
But the rule doesn't say you have to be in foul territory.
That where he was might play out to his advantage.
You do have to be in foul territory because that's where the legal base pass.
Okay, here's my last question for you, Joe Brand. Then you got to go. And that is, should Martinez, the manager for the Nationals who protested that, should he have been thrown out of the game?
I honestly feel like that's a whole other argument because it happened after the play. I feel like the confrontation that happened with the umpires and the manager escalated because, I mean, you look at the one, I forget the third base umpire, he was the crew chief. He kind of smirked at Martinez. He kind of laughed a little bit. I don't always think it's great to mock the manager in the heat of the moment like that. And I know Martinez has been upset with the umpiring crew a few days ago. They gave him a chance. They really did. But I understand the heat of the moment. But again, at the end of the day, the umpires unfortunately did get it right.
And he touched the umpire. I think that's...
He did.
That's,
he did.
That's and the nuclear button.
And his bench coach, Chip Hale, kept trying to... I mean, they gave him a long leash, a very long leash.
Yeah.
And he still kept going with it.
Joe Brand, good to hear you, buddy. I'll talk to you on one Saturday soon, my friend.
Likewise, King. Talk to you later.
King, see?
Nice.
Paperwork.
I'll add just this. Thank goodness for Anthony Rondon.
Because?
He hit the two-run homer after all that.
That's the thing. You think that the guy really would have a case if the Nationals
lost.
We'd be talking
about this for years. But fortunately, two batters later, hits it out of the park, and Nationals have a comfortable lead.
Phil Vitale, a four-star review for is it George or George?
George.
George Trois.
What?
In the Chicago Tribune today, a 12-course meal.
Mm-hmm.
It'll cost me $285. Is it? I've got it here.
$215.
Well, at these prices,
but the 70 is your tip. So there you go.
Is it? Does that include? Is that for two or is that for one?
One.
All right. So Brenda and I were looking at $450 just in and out of the door, and then a tip.
Right, and you probably have something to drink. Besides Agua Fresca.
Sure, so we're on our way to $600 here.
Yep. Next stop, is 600 it, bills.
Okay, so here's another restaurant that maybe the average person doesn't go to on an average day. Is it worth $450 a couple?
It's worth my $450 a
you
couple.
You thought it was terrific.
I thought it was excellent. This guy's been a terrific chef in Chicago for more than 10 years. I loved George Trois when he first opened it. This year, around March, he closed it for a full month to do a whole remodel of the entire building, adding on two other restaurants and making George Trois a real secluded, beautiful space, and I think every change he made works, and it's terrific food.
You said this would have a Michelin star, but it's in Winnetka.
Right, and when they come to Chicago, they jam on the brakes at the city limit, probably a little sooner, actually.
You were teasing a little bit in your review and making that point, but is it really that? If we're not talking Manuka here, which is way out there. It's a little town I grew up in. It's Winnetka, for crying out loud.
Right.
But hard for a Winnetka restaurant to get a Michelin star by geography alone.
Right. Last time I talked to the Michelin representative, he conceded that, yes, they restrict their focus to city proper.
Okay. Well, then maybe it gets one for Winnetka. Or it's probably the best restaurant in Winnetka. It's one of the best in Chicago.
Yeah. It's one of the best in the suburbs. It's arguably the best fine dining restaurant in the suburbs. You can have a couple of fights with a couple of the restaurants, but... they have to be in the conversation.
V is a good one out in Western Springs.
V is a terrific restaurant out in Western Springs. Like Niche all the way out in Geneva. But I would say that really V is the only suburban restaurant that can hold its own with George Trois.
We've been to V a few times. We used to live in LaGrange Park, so on special occasions we'd go out there. If you haven't been to V, you'll drive right by it. It's nothing fancy on the outside.
Mm-hmm. And they have no outdoor seating or anything like that.
It's the most indiscriminate-looking building you'll ever go by. Great restaurant inside. Really terrific staff. So is this George Trois? Is it French? Is it American?
Yes. His whole career has been cooking in the French idiom. That's his training. He was at Café La Cave many years ago. He was the last head chef at Le Français. He opened this place. He had a place in the western suburbs called Les Deux Gros in Glen Ellen, long gone. And he's always been... say contemporary. I mean, respectful of French tradition. Cooks in a more contemporary style, certainly, but it's that kind of thing. It's what Le Français would be doing if it were still around today.
I've annotated your review just to
good idea. I write long.
Well, they only give you so much space. I think you do a nice job, Phil.
Thank you.
But I just wanted to hit some of the words that appeared in your review. You say my meal started with a hot toddy, a ginger mojito. You talked about a cornmeal cake alongside a craggy container of hot corn broth, a dome-shaped potato panier guarding Ocetra caviar and creme fraiche. You talked about the shape of the foie gras. There are fat flakes of burgundy truffle and seared foie medallions. The hits went on, you write, including one or two I'll deliberately omit so as not to spoil the visual surprises.
Yes. He does a couple of tricky things. It's a very novel way of approaching his cheese course. I'll just say that.
You wrote about the lamb loin with its center of garlic duck sausage atop chou, C-H-O-U-X?
Chou
confit.
If I said cabbage, it wouldn't sound so fancy. So I use the French word for cabbage.
And finally, you talk about his miniature souffle, a dessert he's been making for more than a decade. It is picture-perfect sweet. 12 courses, $215 a person, even more if you decide to have a beverage or tip. So 12 courses. How long does it take to eat that much?
It's about a three-hour experience. It might be two and a half, but usually the whole idea is one of the reasons it costs what it costs is generally speaking, he's only seating 16 people in the entire evening. When you sit down, the table's yours. They're not going to be looking at their watch at around 8:45 and wondering if they can get one more foretop in there. No, you're there, and every course is delivered by the chef himself. It's a very intimate experience. So the guy who cooked it, the guy who held it in his hands, is walking up to you and saying, this is what I did, and this is what I had in mind.
That's an interesting point. So the owner chef is there literally presenting the food to you.
Literally presents every dish.
And you said it's not pretentious at all. You're not intimidated. He's a nice guy.
No, he's only intimidated because he's a really big guy. He's really tall. And so if you have a height issue, there's that. But for the most part, no, he makes little separate self-deprecating jokes as he's putting this, like, oh, I couldn't think of anything, so I did. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But, expert technique. This guy is a pro. He won the Jean Mauchet Award for best restaurant just earlier this year in February.
Okay.
So he's, I'm not the only one who thinks he's good.
64 Green Bay Road in Winnetka, GeorgeTroisGroup.com. Wednesday through Sunday, conversation friendly. I have to pause. Come back with me and talk to me about this review in the New York Times.
Sure.
You know the one I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. it's making some news today. What does this restaurant critic say about it? Phil Vitale, restaurant critic, Chicago Tribune. Phil, somebody sent in a note to us last week on the Flash Fry segment. What was that?
It was one of your more astute readers, I think, listeners, who said, John, is there a reason Phil's segment is so short? Could listen to him for a full hour. I think many in Chicago agree. What a lovely person that is.
I sure appreciate you coming by. I wish I did have more time. What about this, Phil? This review by Pete Wells in the New York Times of this steakhouse you know about, Pete Luger's, Peter Luger. And the review starts with this guy going, he loves the smell of the restaurant even as he comes to it. He's been going there for years. Everybody knows Peter Luger's. But he said, now I wonder why anybody goes there at all. He said the management isn't so good. He said the shrimp cocktail has always tasted like cold latex dipped in ketchup and horseradish. The steak sauce has always tasted like the same ketchup and horseradish fortified by corn syrup. He said he looks forward to the potatoes there the same way he looks forward to finding a new, irregularly shaped mole. And on it goes. He had really bad food there.
Yeah, he sure did.
What do you make of that review?
Well, at first I thought, God, did he chip a tooth in there? what exactly? I mean, as you say, the review starts off as this kind of Marcel Proust, you know, fuzzy remembering, and then it just acts like you just shot Marcel Proust's dog. Because he gets really upset. Pete's done this before. He compared the front room to Peter Luger's unfavorably to the DMV in terms of warmth. I mean, the guy can turn a mean phrase when he is sufficiently inspired. Go back one of these days. Go back to the 2012 review he laid on Guy Fieri for Guy's American Kitchen and Bar in Manhattan. It's all every line in the review is a question. And it's, did you know how bad this is?
Really?
Oh yeah, it's considered one of his finest or possibly meanest reviews of all time, but it was repeated and it copied endlessly, as I suspect this one will be. Although it's probably more fun to hate on Guy Fieri than it is Peter Luger's. The equivalent it would be is if I took huge pot shots at, say, Gene and Georgette.
Right, right,
a place
right,
that had been
right.
around that long, that meant so much to Chicagoans, and I just walked in and said,
maybe the bottom line is, we got to go, is don't take your status for granted.
Yeah. I mean, he definitely, the subtext to all of his complaints was, this is a place that has stopped trying, that is just resting on its reputation, and they don't feel like they have to make as much an effort to customers anymore.
3- and 4-star reviews for restaurants in Chicago. Go to chicagotribune.com/dining. Read Phil Vitale.
Please do.
Thank you for coming in, Phil.
My pleasure.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
Watch this.
Here's John Williams.
There we go, all the way until 3. And Rokan, Anna DeVlantis, Lauren Lapka, Kevin Powell. I'll bet Kevin's got a few things to say.
Lord have mercy.
In sports, and that's all coming your way at 3 o'clock. John Williams here until then with a studio full of guests. We rarely do this, but, we have to do this today. We're double digits now. Chicago public school kids not in class. The strike continues. You've been hearing about that. Each day we wonder if this is the day something finally breaks. Today is not that day. We invited some teachers to come into our studio. Chicago public school teachers, members of the Chicago Teachers Union. And in our studio now are 5 of them. So let's just find out a little bit about what their day is like and what it's like in the classroom. In our studio, Jane Haddad. Jane, how are you? Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
What grade do you teach? Where do you teach?
I teach 7th grade English Language Arts at Saucedo Scholastic Academy in Little Village.
Dave Stieber is here. Hi, Dave. How are you?
Good. How are you doing today?
What's your story?
I teach 9th grade human geography at Kenwood and 12th grade poetry, and I'm also the parent of 2 CPS students.
Stephanie Bernardo is here. Hi, Stephanie. How are you?
I'm great.
You're also at Kenwood, is that right?
Yes, and I teach 7th grade through 10th grade math.
How long have the two of you been at Kenwood?
This is actually my first year there, but 6 years in CPS.
Got it. And how about you?
Second year at Kenwood, 13th year in CPS.
And what about you, Jane?
This is my second year at Salcedo and sixth year in CPS. And I also have a student in CPS schools.
Salcedo is in Little Village, and Beth Fiorito also teaches there. Is that right, Beth?
Yeah, that's correct.
What's your story? What do you teach?
So I teach fifth grade English language arts and social studies.
How long have you been at CPS?
So I've taught in CPS neighborhood schools and charter schools for 7 years. This is my second year at Salcedo.
And then next to you is the guy in charge of the band, Carlos Ayeto?
Ayenso, yes.
Ayento. Carlos, what's your story?
My name is Carlos Ayenso. I teach K through 8 music at Salcedo, as well as the band program after school. I'm going into my 18th year at Salcedo, all 18 years at CPS.
So we have great school through high school. We've got language arts, we've got science and math, we've got band. I think we have a nice sort of collection here of the CPS experience. What I'm hearing is that classroom size and support in the classroom is maybe the biggest stumbling block. Is that a big stumbling block for you guys? What about you? What do you say about that?
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge. While I think at Salcedo, our administration works really hard to help us with that and make sure that we have the supports that we need. The fact is that we do have a lot of students with special needs. We are really trying to focus on doing a lot of inclusion of students that are diverse learners, and that just takes a lot of extra support in the classroom.
Do you think too much attention has been spent on 40 kids in a classroom? That number's been thrown out and people lose their minds over it, and I'm not sure that many classrooms have 40 kids. What's your reaction to that, Dave?
Well, I mean, at Kenwood, like, we have a great administration, super supportive, but we're also meant for 1,700 kids, and we have over 2,000. I've got 35 freshmen in my fourth period human geography class. The freshman class is the biggest it's ever been, beating last year's freshman class, which was the biggest it had been at that point. So classes are maxed out, and room space is maxed out, and the halls are very tight to walk through even to get to a class.
When you say, okay, everybody, let's start, 35 kids are sitting in that class, what's that like for you?
That means that two kids are at my desk. That means that kids, I'm teaching and like I'm managing the classroom well, but I'm not giving the kids the individual instruction that they need, even with another teacher who's in that class with me.
How much this is the experience? How much is this not the experience? You say, all right, everybody sit down and be quiet. I'm going to do my lecture now and you're going to take notes and we're going to do it that way. I mean, do you get, why are you shaking your head? I'm not even done with the question. That doesn't happen much?
Lecturing is probably one of the, you know, most ineffective teaching methods.
Okay, so bad. So maybe that was a bad question.
But are you also talking about classroom management? So,
sure. What's it like in the classroom?
Yeah. So, I mean, we all work really hard on classroom management. Good teachers have good classroom management. There's been talk of, like, we want, you know, nationally recommended staffing levels of social workers at our school. So there's been a lot of talk about, you know, oh, they want one at every school. Well, you know, whatever the nationally recommended level is, that's what we'd like to see.
Do you have a social worker at your school?
Yeah, we're lucky. But
5 days a week?
Yeah, but part of that we got through a grant. So we've gotten some support because we've gone above and beyond what CPS has provided for us. So we're kind of in a lucky position. But if you don't, with the kind of discipline that they want us to do, that's more positive and long-lasting and involves some intrinsic work, you really need a social worker to help, so that if a kid's really struggling, and often you see that struggle as a discipline problem in your classroom, that's where you first see it, it's really helpful to have a social worker that you can refer that kid to.
You don't just grab him, throw him out in the hall and say, you're disrupting my class, get
out of here. That's right. There's nobody to watch that kid, first of all. Like, you know, that's not what... it's not effective either. That kid's going to be out there tomorrow.
Dave, why did you laugh at that when I said that?
Well, I mean, it's about, we teach because we love kids, right? And so it's about building relationships with kids to make your classroom an effective space, right? And so if I have 25 kids that I can work and get to connect with and talk to their parents with all the time, I can do that a lot more effectively than if I have 35, right? And so 35 is making me do all the extra stuff plus 10, right? And so, like, I value communicating with parents every day during my prep periods. Like, I value all those things and building positive relationships, because it's not about management. It's about building community in that classroom.
Stephanie, how important is the preparation time for teachers?
I would say it's very invaluable, just because in my experience, I teach both 7th grade pre-algebra and different sections of high school geometry. And given that I have such two drastic curriculum, I need those extra class periods to not only prep the curriculum, but in my geometry classes, I have 8th through sophomores in that class. And we're talking about a wide range of skill sets with math. So I in when we were talking about what instruction looks like in the classroom, my students aren't sitting there taking notes. What's most effective for them is me to create lessons with small group instruction. I differentiated that to their skills.
And is it reasonable to expect the teachers to have that time during the school day to do that, or should the teachers come already prepared to teach? I don't know the answer to that. What do you all say about that?
Well, I mean, I think we would all probably say we do come early and leave late and spend that time preparing lessons. But yeah, you know, to piggyback on what Stephanie's saying, you know, we're also a lot of us probably differentiating lessons so that, you know, it's not just one lesson that we're teaching. We're also making sure that our materials are appropriate for kids at a variety of skill levels. And that just that takes time and it takes preparation.
Beth, what time do you get to school each day?
I'd get to school at 7:30.
And then how long are you there till?
Depending on the day, I leave between 5 and 5:30.
Can you all just share with me your answer to that question? What about you, Stephanie?
Our school day starts at 9. I get there at 7. And depending on how much grading, not until school day ends at 4:15, I leave around 6.
How about you?
I get there about 7:45 for a 9 o'clock start. And then I also coach poetry after school, which means I'm there a lot of days till 6:30 when class ends at 4:15.
How about you, Jane?
I get there between 7:30 and 8. Our school day starts at 9, and I'm usually there till 6:30 when they kick me out of the building, and I also do an after-school drama club. So,
what about you?
8:15 in the morning, same thing, 6:30 at 9 until they kick us out from the building.
And with band, sometimes it's rehearsals on weekends and things like that,
yep.
Too.
To Saturday rehearsals programs. Sometimes, yes.
Where were you all on the idea that the student-athletes should be able to play? You know, maybe the coaches or the band directors say, I'm going to get paid anyway. I'll just show up. Even if I didn't get paid, I think a lot of the coaches and extracurricular activity faculty advisors would say, I want this for the kids. Would any of you have been interested in, you know, quote unquote, crossing the picket line for the extracurricular activities?
I mean, we're part of the union. That's something you just, I think throughout the board, throughout the whole CTU union is that we would not cross that picket line, even if it was for any kind of activities. My band is going to have to do some extra work when we do come back from the strike to try to prepare for competitions and stuff for March. But, you know, that's, you know, we can't, you know.
Yeah, I would also want to look into that more because what I had read last was that it was a district decision.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't up to the teachers.
It didn't get that far.
It didn't get that far. So we didn't get to say, yeah, we're, you know, this isn't crossing the line. We're still, you know, in our capacity as teachers, but also teachers on strike, and we can get these kids to these competitions. It's our understanding the district told the kids no.
And it also kind of goes into the idea of, like, it's a short-term pain. We're trying to change the way school's been done in Chicago for generations, and so this is a very intense sacrifice for these students, right, and for us to be away from these students, but, like, to fundamentally change an education system that's not looked out for its students, that's what our overall goal is.
At Saucedo, what percentage of these students are on some sort of economic assistance for breakfast and lunch? You know, that's one way they sort of characterize the socioeconomic status of the students. What is it at your school?
Yeah, so I think if you go by both free and reduced, we're at 100%. There's another calculation, but we come out at like 97%. So
it's a fairly poor student population base that you're dealing with there.
Yeah, in order to qualify for free and reduced lunch, you have to be below, I believe it's like the 25th percentile in income.
And so how many students at your school again?
We're a little over 1,000 right now.
Yeah. What about at Kenwood? Can you answer the same sort of questions? What's it like at Kenwood?
I think at Kenwood, because we have such a mixed program where a good portion of our students are from the neighborhood, Hyde Park and Kenwood area, but we, in our academic center, they test in. Our percentages are more a little over 70% free reduced, and this is a very rough estimate. And just in terms of student population, they come not only from that neighborhood, but all over the city. Yeah.
If you had one thing that you would hold out for, and I don't want to talk too much about contract negotiation. Mm-hmm. Lord knows we hear the two sides on the news enough. But in the classroom, is there something that you're rooting for, Carlos, that you thought, boy, if we're out for 2 weeks, I sure hope we get this. What would it be for you?
For me personally, this is more of a personal thing. Many people don't know that music is not a requirement in the CPS. It's by how large the school is. So and it's either art or it's either music, one or both.
If you mean the school doesn't even have to have a music program?
That's correct.
You're not saying that it has to be a requirement for the students, but at least give them the option, require the school to provide that. And they don't even provide, that's not mandated.
So the way music and art works is if you're over, I believe, 501 or certain number of students, you have... You get both art or music or double art or double music. But for me personally, I would like to see better funding for arts education. You know, since we don't get any funding, I had to spend a lot of my own personal money on, you know, things like repairs, getting new instruments.
I'm going to ask you about that in a second, how much you all would estimate you came out of your pocket. But before we get to that, what's your wish, Beth, for the school, for this contract?
I really, really want to see some kind of accountability for class sizes being too large. At Salcedo, I think we've been very, don't want to say lucky, but yeah, lucky. I mean, our administration they really understand how important that is. And I think that my personal class is at a size that is manageable, but I've taught at other schools where that's definitely not the case.
And the mayor says, well, we'll put $20 million toward that, but they're not putting in writing the guarantee that you'll have below this number.
Right. So they've talked about different ways to, like, solve that problem. But yeah, like, unless you have some way to, like, hold them accountable for going over that, like, that's a really difficult thing.
Yeah, they've actually said that they put $35 million towards that. But there's 40,000 that are in overcrowded classrooms. And so if you divide $35 million over a five-year contract, that's $7 million a year, divided by 40,000 children, that's $175 a kid. It's, you know... Yes, we're talking
about the problem, does it?
Yeah.
Okay, stay right there. Jane is in our studio. Dave, Stephanie, Beth, and Carlos. I want you to, the other three of you, answer that question. What's your wish? And I wonder what your out-of-pocket expenses have been as Chicago Public School teachers, say this year in a given year. It's 221, and this is WGN. Five Chicago Public School teachers are in our studio. We're talking about what their classrooms and teaching experiences are like. So thank you all for being here. This will be a short segment. We'll do the news and then come back and talk to me some more, guys. But Carlos and Beth and Stephanie and Dave and Jane, we've introduced them a moment ago. Let's just pick it up where we left off. Stephanie, we're talking about if there was one thing you had on your wish list for this contract, what would you be glad you held out for?
I think overall, speaking to Beth's point about accountability and class size, I would just say accountability overall and everything that CPS and the mayor has been proposing. I think a lot of the frustrations from previous contracts has been lack of accountability for what they had promised. And everything that we're fighting for is for the betterment of the experiences of our students. And whatever we get, I just hope it sticks.
So does that mean you don't trust them when they say, don't worry, we're going to get that, we just can't put that in writing?
I would say so, just from my experience.
What about you, Dave?
I absolutely don't trust. I've been 13 years in the system, and I've been lied to for 13 years.
What's the thing you want to have in this contract?
My partner and I are both CPS teachers. We have two kids that attend CPS elementary school, pre-K and second grade. So pre-K, we just had to strike to get preschoolers to be able to take naps in school. We had to strike to get it to be a 10-to-1 ratio of adults to kids, even though that's state law. Like, we had to strike to get that. And I teach my kids, right, are in the system. And so it's very personal to me. Like, obviously I love my students, but I'm going to pick my kids, right, over. And so, like, to have both, like, I'm fighting for both my students who I've been fighting for 13 years and then also my own children.
So what's the item? What's the line item?
I want everything that elementary school teachers want. I want that for them. I want them to have that extra time that they need to plan to look out for, like, all the elementary school students.
Jane, what's your short answer to that?
What I want?
Yeah.
I want... Maybe accountability for a class size would fix a lot of what I want, but it's bigger than that because I want my prep time, and I would also like that we hold them accountable for the support staff they say they're going to get us for bilingual, you know, English language learners, which is a huge issue at the Little Village School, and then also the diverse learners, the special ed.
I want to know what your interaction with the parents and the families are like. I want to know what comes out of your pocketbook. We said we'll break for the news here, but then continue to talk to me. Do you all have a few more minutes? You are not on the line today, right? Maybe you'll go back out on the...
We actually left the line. We had a protest at the 78, so...
I appreciate you coming here.
Because the players gonna play, 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 play. And the haters gonna hate, 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 hate.
Thank you, Steve Bertrand. 2:35, this is John Williams. Producer Alex got a song for us after the 2:30 news. Why are you playing this today?
Taylor Swift's victory in the copyright lawsuit against her song Shake It Off has been appealed. The plaintiff wrote, "Play is gonna play."
So is that optimistic for her case? Is that what you're saying?
Opposite. She won the original case, and now it's been appealed. Her victory has been appealed.
All right, so stay tuned, because I don't know how Taylor's going to get along if she loses that thing. It is 2:36 on WGN. Okay, we're talking with some Chicago public school teachers. I appreciate the time, and I might even go so far as to say courage of Jane Haddad, who is here, as well as Dave Stieber, Stephanie Bernardo, Beth Fiorito, correct, Beth? And also Carlos Ayento. They teach in the Chicago Public School a range of classes from band to math, history, English. And we're just talking about what their experience is like. Three of our guests teach at Saucedo, right, which is in Little Village. And Dave and Stephanie are over at Kenwood Academy. Carlos, how much would you say comes out of your pocket? You're on the music side.
Yes.
So I don't know, maybe it's less, maybe it's more. How much are you all personally spending as teachers at CPS?
So through all the receipts and all through the stuff that I do for tax records, it comes to about an average of $10,000.
$10,000 what?
$10,000 out of my own pocket.
A year.
A year.
Are you serious?
I'm very serious.
Can you, do you get redeemed for any of that?
$250.
Okay, so $9,500, $9,750, right? Math teacher, comes out of your pocket.
Yes.
$9,000? And do you get to write that off on your taxes?
Just $250, according to the last previous legislation.
What do you spend that money on?
Supplies, repairs.
To instruments?
To instruments. So many instruments I own for the
registration
students.
Registration fees for competitions,
buses.
Don't the parents or the kids pay that?
And we also fundraise. So that's on top of the fundraising money that we do make, you know.
How typical are you, Carlos, in that? Do other band directors?
I would say in the music world, it is not uncommon for a lot of music educators to put in their personal money to supply their programs because they're not underfunded.
Carlos,
CPS.
You don't have to tell me how much you earn, but I'm going to guess it's $70,000 a year, something like that?
Around that, yes.
Okay, so then $10,000 comes off the top just for you to do the job for the kids.
That's correct.
What about you, Beth?
I would say the first year I taught, I spent around $2,000, but I've been working to bring that down every year. Just less the money, as just like as a professional, I'd feel like I should be given what I need to do my job. So I've really been trying to cut that back. Last year, I spent probably about $500, $250 of which was reimbursed.
Is it the position of all of you that I shouldn't have to spend anything? I mean, I'm educating.
That's
this is a public
position.
School.
Yeah, right. I know other people may feel differently if they're like feeling altruistically called to do that. But I feel like as a professional that I should have what I need to do my job.
Do any of you want to volunteer on this? What do you say?
Reality of the world and professionally, and there's also the teacher reality we have to face. As educators, we know what our students need, and if even though I can't get access to those resources, I know the benefits they can have to my students, so I'm going to work towards it. I would echo Beth's sentiment. First couple years, I spent a couple $1,000s each year, but being creative, a lot of us go through Donors Choose or other avenues to try to fundraise and get grants, but
thank goodness for those things. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Either of you want to chime in on this? Pardon me. Go ahead.
That's okay. Based off what Stephanie was saying too, like I coach poetry, right? And so like coaching poetry, if you're not familiar, like Chicago is the world's largest youth poetry slam and louder than a bomb. And so like I spend over 100 hours of my own time for free doing poetry, right? And so with 100 hours with students after school, that's a lot of food. That's a lot of CTA rides. That's a lot of stuff that I'm paying for in my own pocket, right? So I'm talking like at least $1,000 a year just off my own paycheck on top of that.
Yeah.
And Donors Choose, right, is great, but also like our school should be able to fund laptops and computers and all that stuff too.
Jane, jump in here. You can answer that, but also let's not dwell on this too much, but I hear that with this contract, you guys are going to make $94,000 to $100,000 a year at the end of the contract, and that you're not that far from it right now. What's the reality of that?
So at our school, there's one teacher who makes more than $100,000
And I think they've been in CPS for 28 years.
How many teachers at your school?
There's about 100.
So 100 teachers, yeah, and one of them is six figures.
And it's all public knowledge. I mean, if you looked and you compiled what our average was, I mean, I think it would probably come out to 65 because the huge chunk of teachers are making 62 or less, like between 56 and 62. Mm-hmm. And that number, Dave can speak to this more because a math teacher at Kenwood, you know, crunched those numbers. But that's that 100K, that's what the average teacher is going to make, is predicated upon them staying in the system and being in the system longer than 11 years, which most teachers don't.
If you want to see what she's talking about, the CTU union has a whiteboard. Math teacher stands up there and says, okay, here's... And then, like a good math teacher, he, in very understandable terms, explains and displays how the numbers get there and how realistic or unrealistic it is. But what do you all make of the fact that people get hung up on this? $100,000. I'd like $100,000 for 9 months and a long Christmas break.
We were talking about this earlier. Teaching is a craft. There's other jobs that are a craft. I used to be an auditor. I was a CPA. And every single year, we got more money because they knew that every single year you were getting that much more experience. And that wasn't capped out after 14 years like it is in CPS. You know, teachers that have 14 years in the system haven't had a raise, even a cost of living raise, in 8 years. So
CPS teachers with the contract they've had have not been getting raises?
Right. Since 2012, teachers that have 14 or more years in CPS have not had a raise, not even a cost of living adjustment.
Why, do you cap out at a certain point? Is that what it is?
They capped out the 2012 contract at step 14, year 14. And so whatever you had at that time, that's it. Even if you got a master's or whatever. If you had a master's at step 14.
Okay, I didn't realize that. Yeah. But I mean, Beth, you were talking about this off the air, and you can all chime in on this. You understand the frustration that some people in the community have when they hear $100,000? I mean, what's your reaction to that generally? I thought your point was that the union, well, it's what you guys were talking about off the air, I'm sure you don't mind my repeating it, needs to present its case better. If this was a marketing class, I would say, whatever the issues are, the union is not representing the teacher's position as well as it should.
Yeah, absolutely. So what I was saying was, you know, we're teachers, but we're doing a terrible job of teaching the public about what our schools need and what the problems are in our schools.
Because we just keep hearing $100,000, hearing $100,000. And we see your union representatives stridently making your case on TV, but I think people watch that and they go, wait a minute, $100,000. They keep hearing $100,000, Dave. They keep hearing $100,000.
Yeah, I mean, the city's doing a great job of saying, you know, the same thing when it gets up in front of the press. You know, we have to have some good sound bites where, you know, we can counter that each and every
time.
Okay,
so the 100 teachers at your school, only one person is
only
making
one.
Do any idea
and
what
that's
it's
all
like
public knowledge. You can look that up.
Plenty of kids have looked up their teachers, trust me, if it's a public school. What's it like at Kenwood?
So, I mean, the thing, too, is like, so I'm in my 13th year teaching, right? And I'm 39 years old. Like, I am considered old now in CPS because most teachers, there's a big exodus at year 7. Teachers leave the CPS to go to the suburbs because you can get paid more, a lot more, and you have more resources, right? And so then if you make it past year 7, then there's another big exodus around year like 11, right? And so like
You cap out at 10.
Because you cap out at 14, right? And so there's this cap, right? And so you don't value experience. And also with student-based budgeting, schools get paid now, like they get a certain amount of money. And if you have experienced teachers, they cost more. I'm nationally board certified with my master's. I cost more than a new teacher, right? But even though I have more experience and expertise, schools don't care because I still cost more. And their bottom line is this.
I would think they would want more of you.
That's if in a perfect world, that would make sense.
You're a white male with a master's degree. I want more men. I want more men of color. I want master's degrees. I mean, I would think they would value that, right?
That's too expensive at that point, though.
Carlos, what did you want to say?
I want to say, you know, a lot of people don't realize that for a CPS teacher to retire fully without any kind of penalties, they have to have roughly 34 years of teaching and be at least, I want to say, 56. So if our cap is at 16, so virtually more than half of their career, they're making the same amount of money from year 16 all the way till 34. I'm at year 18. So I'm already 18.
So you're 18, you don't get a raise, and you're 19, and you're 20, nope. and so forth? Not on the contract
not,
you're
not
on right
contract.
Now. This new contract would give you a raise if you all assigned the one?
Very minimal.
Really? I thought you're not going to
be
one of those?
I think it comes out to about $500 a person.
I'm sorry, I thought I heard it was 16% over 5 years. That wouldn't apply to you in your case?
Just as a small increment, but not like where other teachers still making annually. So the first 14 steps, you know, teachers make a percentage increase, you know, as a trade. As they're improving, they're getting more money. But after a certain year, which is year 14, they stop. So you're making the same amount of money. The only raise you do get is either through contract negotiations or through, you know, these raises, which is very minimal.
You're the music teacher who said
That's
you
correct.
Spent $10,000 this year. This year?
On your every year.
And some people just don't believe that. The texts are not sure that that's the truth.
Yep, I have my tax records to prove it. You know, so it's. I know a lot of people think, some people say, well, you do it by choice. Well, I have to do it. If I don't do it, I don't have a program. I can't do what I need to do as an effective music teacher and band director to compete against other schools that do have those funds to, you know...
How much of this is about the students, you guys? What is your interaction with the students like? Are there kids in the Chicago Public Schools in your classrooms who are bringing so much crap to school every day with their family and the city and the crime that it's really hard to teach them? Or are they surprisingly like the kids I might find in the suburbs, and they're here to learn, and they like engaging, and they're quote-unquote good students? What's walking in your door, Stephanie, every day?
I would say a great percentage of my students come with so much trauma from home, given that we're in the Kenwood Hyde Park area and from surrounding areas. This year alone, I have a set of twins in one class where their family lost everything from a fire, and just trying to catch up with online homework and being transitional from different homes of family members, there's no stability, and their story isn't unique either. Right. So whether it's instability at home or just with who they're with when they go after school, a lot of obstacles stand in their way from being able to learn.
How do you answer that, Beth? What's walking in the door for you each morning?
Well, as you said that, my reaction, you're like, is it either like the suburbs or is it kids with trauma? My answer is yes. they're great kids. The kids that I teach are great kids. And I'm sure there are kids with trauma going to suburban schools, too. But I do think in the city there are more kids experiencing homelessness or, you know, in temporary living situations where they're moving around or they're doubled up with family members or bringing in other kinds of traumatic experiences.
What about the rest of you? Is there a student? Is there a scenario you came home and you told your partner or spouse or whoever you come home to, boy, I had to put up with this today? And put up with, I'm not criticizing a kid or a sad family. I'm just wondering, wow, this is your reality. Is there something that comes to mind when
you know, my daughter went to CPS school. She just graduated in June. And I mean, her first week of high school, she came home one day crying. And I said, what's happening? And she's like, I can't tell you. And I said, well, if you could just tell me, you know, next week or, you know, Monday or whatever, because she said she would tell me the next week and that it had something to do that happened at school. And she had made a new friend that week who she discovered had been cutting herself. And the reason why she had been cutting herself was because of something that was happening at home with her mother's boyfriend. And she was afraid it was going to happen to her younger sister. And she didn't know who to talk to. And I mean, these are, you know, I know this can happen anywhere in any suburb, city, town or whatever. But there was, on top of all of that, like an immigration threat, like the person that was perpetrating the crime on them would be threatening to turn them into immigration. And I just think in the city, we have more kids like that in our system that are extremely vulnerable. And then if you add any kind of learning issue on top of that, an English language learning issue or diverse, you know, special education, we have a large vulnerable population.
Answer that question, Dave, and then answer this question. Tell me something you're especially proud of that you really think is fantastic about your school or your students.
Okay. So the reason we're all here, the reason we've been on strike for 10 days is because we absolutely love our students and we're willing to do whatever it takes for our students. I'd rather be teaching any day of the week. I've taught in other schools besides Kenwood that have a lot of challenges. I've dealt with student death. I've dealt with students being killed by the police. And we need social workers and counselors to help our students deal with that, but also to help us deal with that. I'm still not able to fully talk about those things. I don't want to talk about those things, but like it impacts all of our students every single day and us. The things I'm most proud of, right, is like I have a student who I just saw on the strike line, and she's now a Sika, right? She works at a school helping out in schools, and she got her master's at UIC. And like I was literally striking.
A Sika is a special education assistant.
Thank you. She works one-on-one with a student with special needs. And I taught her, and she graduated in 2012. I taught her. She went to get her master's at UIC with me, or the same program as me. I'm older. And then also, then I saw her on the strike line, and like I'm literally striking to get her so she can get a basic living wage, right? And then I see her fighting for her own students, and it's like, that's literally what we do it for, like to see our kids grow and mature and just be successful.
It's Dave Stieber from Kenwood Academy. Stephanie Bernardo is sitting next to him. Beth Fiorito is in our studio. Carlos Siento and Jane Haddad. We'll just have a couple of minutes when we come back. It's 2:51, and this is WGN. It's rare that we do this, take a whole hour and put a bunch of people in the studio. I thought it was a good idea, and I'm glad that we've had the time to do this. Thank you, Jane Haddad, from Saucedo, which is one of the schools in the Chicago public school system in Little Village, and then also from Kenwood Academy. Dave Stieber's here, Stephanie Bernardo, Beth Fiorito, and Carlos Siento are also from Saucedo. If we run out of time, thank you all for coming into our studio.
Thanks for having
me. Is there something else? We just got a couple minutes, guys, that you want to say? Is there something else that maybe I haven't asked that, I mean, my pitch to you all was, tell me what your experience is like, what I don't know when I watch TV. What do you want to say, Carlos?
I think a lot of people just don't know the amount of hours that we put in. There's a, you know, when people say, oh, they don't need prep time, we put a lot of our own personal time without getting any sort of compensation.
Okay, I asked you that question, and I don't mean to cut your answer off, but that's a point that I think all of you might say, and I know what my listeners are thinking. We put in a lot of prep time, too. The average person works 48, 50 weeks a year, and they're there from 8 to 6, and they take their work home on weekends. So Carlos, respond to that, if you will. How is your experience different than everybody else's, or is it different than everybody else's?
I think since we're working with actual students, it's not like you're taking other things. You're looking out for the students' well-being day after day after day, and trying to prepare for what's going to make them successful in the future. I've had many of my own personal students become either music teachers themselves over the years or professional jazz musicians, and you know, that wouldn't have been possible if I hadn't planned in any kind of proper lessons with them since they've been in kindergarten till they graduated from eighth grade.
So it's more than just a job, it's lives.
It's a career, it's a passion. You know, you have to love to do this job.
Beth, what's your response to all of this, too? Is there something you want our audience to know before we all wrap it up here?
Yeah, sure. I think we're all teachers because we love what we do, and we love our students. And I think you've been talking a lot about, like, you know, people in your audience are probably thinking like, oh man, those teachers, like, what are they complaining about? They got it so great. So yeah, like there are perks to our job. Like you mentioned, a lot of vacation time, and that's certainly something we signed up for. But you know, I don't see anyone complaining that their doctor makes too much money, right? And that's like, teaching is a similarly complex job. Maybe, you know, we didn't go to school as long as a doctor did, but like in terms of like what our work is, I think that people have a misunderstanding that the work is less complicated, or that like they know what it is because they've been a student and they've like seen it and they think that they understand what that work is. But there's a lot of like, you know, diagnosing what's going on with students and assessing them and figuring out what's coming next. And it's I think that it's complicated work, and we are professionals, and I think that we deserve to be compensated for that.
Yeah. Do you think that the contract offer is at least fair comp? Nobody has here said that the money is not fair compensation for the work. You all have been talking about prep time and assistance in the classroom.
I personally feel like my compensation is workable for me. I think that we've spent a lot of time in this contract negotiation talking about, you know, raising the bottom for the people who are right. making the lowest wages. And I think that's fair.
Before we run out of time, what's Team Lakewood say over here?
I say overall at Kenwood, and it's the similar sentiment, we're really just fighting for quality education for each of our students since it's their right. And a lot of what we're fighting for, aside from compensation, are just basic things that all schools within most states and within suburban areas, they get. And it's legally required. It's just, as what was mentioned earlier, we have to strike in order to get those laws.
Got it. And how about you, Dave?
I would say I would ask the mayor to look at her kid's private school, and I would ask mm-hmm. people listening to listen, look at their suburban schools and say, look at what those schools have. Our schools don't have anything like that. And so if you see what your school has and be like, wow, I wish our school had more in the suburbs. Well, we wish our school had five times more than that. Right? We wish our kids had 15 kids in a class like private schools do. They don't. They have 35.
I got 30 seconds left.
I would go back to, we're asking for basic things. We really are. If you compare us to other school districts, we're asking for basic things and having to strike to get those. And also, I don't think it's fair for the city to put on the backs of its teachers, police, fire, water, sewer, whoever doesn't have a fair contract, park district, service employee unions, to put 25 years of their financial mismanagement on our backs. We deserve a fair contract.
You can email me what you think about this segment, johnwilliams@wgnradio.com. We didn't take calls. I've only read a few texts here, but we're sure getting a large reaction. So I'm johnwilliams@wgnradio.com. Hey, thanks for listening to my podcast. This is John Williams. I'm live weekdays from 1 to 3. And remember, our Mincing Rascals podcast drops Thursdays at 5. The Rascals is a round table of talkers and journalists. This year, judged best in the state by the Illinois Broadcasters Association.